Session number 30388, reel 4.
If we move on to your efforts to join up. Mm-hmm.
Well, in 1942, I read in a newspaper advertisement that the Polish consulate in London required all Polish citizens aged from 17 to 17 and a half, report there for medicals with a view to joining the Polish services. So I went. It was a day away from work, and I had the medical, and I passed. There were about 20 odd of us youngsters, and we were then each interviewed. I'd made it quite clear at the beginning that I would only speak English. And when it came to it, the officer said, well, we're likely to call you within the next few weeks. I said, I'm sorry, sir, but I must decline the invitation because I cannot speak Polish. Oh, we'll soon teach you. I said, sir, I have not been brought up in your culture. I've never been to Poland. I cannot speak Polish. My culture is English. I've been brought up in the English public school system or something like that. And I shall join the British forces when they'll have me. All right, we'll give you 6 months deferment. And that was that. When the 6 months were over, so more or less, anyway, because I was just 17 at the time, and it was, would have been about April, May 1942, about October, I went to the recruiting office in Birmingham to offer my services, having made sure right at the beginning for my employment that they would let me go, because it was a reserved occupation, that they would let me go if the call came to join the forces. So I reported to the recruiting office and to join the army, and they said, sorry, son, the army's full up. We're not taking any recruits. Try the Air Force. I was somewhat taken aback, but went over to the Air Force desk and was greeted with the remark, oh, you wear glasses, are you short-sighted? I said, just a little bit. Oh, well, you're no good for flight crew then. And are you a member of the ATC, which is the Air Training Corps? And I said, no. Oh, well, you can't have you for ground staff either, ground crew either, because we only take people from the ATC. And I went out very disappointed. It never occurred to me to try the naval desk, because I'd been told you had to be three generations British through and through. So I went home and wrote a long, detailed letter to my local MP, whose name was Oliver Simmons, complaining and expressing the desire that I wished him to help me to get called up for the forces. We got a very nice, positive reply from him, and waited. Some weeks or maybe a month or two later, I happened to be in a pub when a fellow came up to me and started to pull my leg by saying, hey, I thought you'd be fighting for Kigan country by now. And I realized this was a chap who worked at the recruiting office there in Birmingham. And I explained to him what had gone wrong. And he said, well, why don't you try the Navy? I said, the Navy don't take foreigners, I'm Polish. He said, eh, they'll take anybody these days. So shortly afterwards, I went again, and I went straight to the naval desk and offered my services. Yes, certainly. I said, I'm Polish, you know. Doesn't matter. Good. What sort of service do you want to do? I still remember, I literally replied, I want to kill Germans. And they said, well, you know, from the sound of it, I think you're a bit too well educated to be just an ordinary seaman or stoker. Why don't you try telegraphy? I said, telegraphy? He said, you know, wireless operator. Oh, yes, that sounds all right. He said, right, we'll put you down for telegraphist. He said, there's a 3 months waiting time for medicals, but we've got a vacancy tomorrow through a cancellation. Would you like it? And I said, you bet. And I took it. And I passed with flying colors. Had the interview, had to take the papers to another office where they dealt with it and passed them on to the Admiralty or wherever, and went home a happy laddie. when I came home in the evening, there were some OHMS letters lying there awaiting me, one of which was from the War Office, telling me to report for a medical in a week's time with a view to joining the army. And I was a bit taken aback, but having been brought up in this sort of Germanic way, if you like, one must obey sort of thing, it didn't occur to me to ignore this. So on the appointed day, I went and had the same medical all over again with the same people, who all of them said, "What are you doing here? We saw you last week." Long and short of it, I went before the officer, who was a very blimpish major, speaking in the most plummy accent. And he said to me, part of the army would you like to serve in as a volunteer? You can choose. I said, "The Royal Navy, sir." He said, no, this is the army. I said, "I know, sir, but I've already volunteered for and been accepted by the Royal Navy, and I would prefer to join the Royal Navy." "No, I've got special instructions about you from the War House." He called it the War House, the War Office. "You have to state the preference." So anyway, I said, "All right, Royal Armoured Corps." And that was that. And again, I had to take these papers to this office, which vetted them and then passed them on. And I said to the chap in charge, "Said, do me a favour, lose these or do something. I was here last week, as you know, and I'd rather join the Navy than the Army." He said, "Well, I'll do what I can," but he wasn't very helpful.
Why the Royal Armour Corps? Why the Royal Armour Corps?
Because I didn't want to walk. Didn't fancy foot slogging, to be honest. I don't know why, because I enjoy walking. And hiking, for that matter. Well, even mountain walking these days, I did anyway. So it seemed more comfortable to ride. I'm glad the Navy got through first, because I don't think I'd be sitting if I'd been in the Army. I might have been on the D-Day beaches and one of those things, getting shot to hell. So I waited, and nothing came through, and I was on this knife edge. Who's going to come in first? But then one day I came home for my dinner, and I sensed a suppressed excitement in the family, because they treated me as a member of the family. But I thought, well, maybe it's a birthday or something. They gave me my dinner, and only after I'd eaten my dinner did my landlady pass me on the old HMS envelopes, one of which contained the call from the Navy with instructions to report to HMS Royal Arthur. It's previously known as Butlin's Holiday Camp in Skegness, on a certain date by 2 o'clock. Certain trains, they gave you train times even. And on the appointed day, I said goodbye to my host family and set off by train. We had to change, I think, at Crewe or somewhere like that. And I was in a compartment all on my own when a young man walked in and sort of said, "Do you mind if I sit here?" I said, "No, it's a free country, you know, you can sit here." And it turned out he was also going to HMS Royal Arthur, and not only that, he was also going to be a telegraphist like myself. So we got chatting, and he was a very nice young man who'd been working in a bank. Philip Anstey was his name. I still remember that. I've got a good memory for names sometimes. We got friendly, and we decided we'd stick together. We reported in, we went through all the usual bump of sort of the paperwork and allocation of huts and blah blah. And the following day we were due to have various tests, medicals and so on. And I remember the medical, we were warned to be on our best behavior, because one of the officers doing the medicals was a lady, a Wren officer, a Wren doctor. And we were warned by petty officers of any man misbehaving, not wink wink type thing, is likely to be on a charge. So there was some trepidation. We were all young men. And all went well. And she had to do the intimate, what was known as the short arm inspection. You bent down and looked up your rear end and used the glass rod to look at your front end and so on. Anyway, everything went okay. And then we started a routine of square bashing, learning how to march and that sort of thing. We used to eat in the mess hall there, and I regret to say that in the first days there was an incident which was quite unpleasant, because it was Irish stew for dinner, and we were a crowd of maybe 60 or so. We stuck together as a class, you know, and we sat in the dining room occupying two adjacent tables, and this stew was doled out. And there's one chap sitting there saying, God, he said, this is bloody awful stuff. It's all gristle. Can't eat this. And he spat it out and then realised that what we'd been chewing on was a condom. And some wag said, has it been used? So he threw up and everybody else walked out at the time. Of course, it didn't make any difference to us, but it was a bit disgusting. That was the only nasty experience as far as that mess hauling was concerned. Otherwise, the food was okay and plentiful.
Was it discovered how it came to be there?
No. No, you don't discover things like that. Somebody thought it was a joke. I mean, to be honest, I was in a group of people who were, when we were later in Aberdeen, we blew up condoms and floated them across the town and got ticked off for it too. But we had to do certain duties, one of which was fire watching. We lived in these typical huts from holiday camps, but you know, you've got the big blocks with flat roofs. And in the corner of each big block of the flat roof, there was a fire watching station, which consisted of, I can't remember, two chairs or a bench or something, a stirrup pump, a bucket of water, a bucket of sand, and something like that. You had to do fire watching duty, everybody. And to get there, you had to go up rungs that were vertically set into the side of the building with no handrails. You just had to climb up, which wasn't a terribly pleasant sensation. But anyway, I found myself up there. We worked in pairs, and our instructions were to watch out for German aircraft. And should we hear or see any, to blow our whistles and to come down so that the regular firefighters could take our places. On my second such tour, I did that twice during my fortnight there, on my second occasion, I was up there. I don't know whether I'd been drinking too much, but it was midnight. We had the midnight to 2 o'clock watch, the worst one to lot. And we were up there in the pitch dark, and it was November, and cold and miserable, and with a sort of dampness in the air. And I got caught short. I had to go, and you can't go down, it's desertion. So I said to my fellow watcher, I don't know what to do. I said, I've got to have a pee. He said, do it over the side. Well, it was pitch dark, and so in the end, I had to do something, so I did exactly what he suggested. I urinated over the side of the building, only to hear a rather plummy voice down below saying, I say, chaps, we'd better get a move on, it's starting to rain. I tell you, we kept very, very quiet up there, because they were obviously officer types down there, and I must have peed on them, that's all I can think of, but nothing was ever said, nobody ever discovered anything, so presumably the thing just passed off. From there, we were, after a fortnight, as a class, transferred to Wetherby in Yorkshire for toughening up training. Wetherby was a very tight camp in the sense that there was no chance of getting out. You couldn't go to the local pubs, bars or cinemas or anything. We were virtually confined to barracks for 3.5 weeks or whatever we were there. And I settled in there, and we started to be giving a lot of physical training. Exercises, gym, marching with rifles, without rifles, with gas masks and rifles and all that nonsense. We also had to do guard duty around the perimeter. Yes, darling? You coming in? about the one that left the door open. Yes, we were put through it, and in order to suppress any unnatural desires, our tea was heavily laced with bromide. And I have to say, it never had any effect on me. I'm sure it didn't have much effect on anybody else. But one of the things we had to do there, and that was an early morning run, and we're talking November, December. It would be December already, which was like a cross-country run, wearing only plimsolls, no socks, shorts, which were tropical shorts that were issued to us specifically for this purpose, no pants, but a vest. And it was freezing cold. And we used to go sort of through the part of built-up area where there was some factories and some hostels, into woods and uphill and down dale, and with a petty officer in charge. The only trouble was, all these tropical shorts we were issued with were second-hand, obviously no longer of use for normal work, and most of them had no fly buttons, or mainly one fly button only. So things being, having to run, one tended inadvertently to expose oneself when running along. And our petty officers had this sense of humor of making us run past a war workers' hostel where there were a lot of women who invariably were shouting rude remarks out of the windows. I won't go into the details. If you lagged behind, you had to do circuits of the parade ground. So it was tough going, but most of us coped pretty well with this. With this marching business, every instructor vied to win the pennant at the end of the period concerned, and consequently made our lives hell. We all had to do guard duty around the perimeter to make sure nobody was coming in under the fence or going over the fence illegally. But I was able, on two occasions, to go to that hotbed of sin called Leeds. And this was the result, I must confess, of my being Jewish, because a notice appeared that all ratings of the Jewish faith who wished to attend Saturday synagogue services could get a leave pass to go to Leeds by bus early on Saturday morning and return in the afternoon. No time being specified, I'm pleased to say. I went for this. There was only one other chap who went. There were two of us. We went together. Our intention was to have a good look around Leeds, go to the cinema, go dancing, go and eat some fish and chips or something. But we had pangs of conscience and thought, well, they might ask us when we come back, which synagogue did you go to? Where was it? So we found a synagogue. And we went in. And the service hadn't started because to hold a full service, you need a quorum of 10 adult males. And there were only 8 adult males there and about 15 women. So we coming in there were godsends. They were able to start the service. We took part and we stayed. When we finished, one of the members of the congregation came up to us and said, thank you, boys, for making up the quorum here and so on. Would you like to have lunch at my home? Oh, thank you very much, sir. Well, he said, we're not supposed to drive. He said, but my car is two roads away, such and such. That's the number. Meet me there in 10 minutes. So he must have been one of the sort of senior members of the congregation or something. And we met him there, and he took us to his home, which was outside the center of the town, and took us upstairs, he had a little office in the house, and before he even introduced us to the wife, took us in there and plied us with a large scotch each and himself as well, and gave us each a packet of 20 cigarettes and so on, and said, right, and then called out to his wife and said, I've got two guests for lunch, said, two sailors and so on, and marched us in, and there we meet the wife and the two daughters. one uglier than the other. They really were most unattractive girls. Well, they were very nice and pleasant to us, but Jewish women have a reputation of being good cooks. This one was the exception proves the rule. She was an awful cook. But anyway, we had our meal, and as soon as we decently could, we made our way back, saying we had to be back in camp in the afternoon, which was a lie. We found a palais de danse somewhere and went in with a view to enjoying ourselves and seeing what was going on in there, you know. And we'd only been in there about half an hour or so, when to our horror, in walked these two ugly sisters. And so we made a quick getaway before they spotted us and caught the bus back to camp. The next time we went, we didn't bother with the synagogue, but we enjoyed ourselves in other ways. Another thing that happened in Wetherby was they used to bus us into Harrogate twice a week into the swimming baths, which were reserved exclusively to us at the times that we were taking there. This meant we didn't need to wear swimming trunks, we were all in the nude, and this was to give us swimming instructions. Now, I had been a strong swimmer since the age of 5, and I was utterly shocked to notice that the vast majority of these young naval recruits didn't know how to swim. And I was one of the good swimmers, and I was able to assist the instructors there in teaching the chaps how to stay afloat and all that in the shallow end. When they were deemed to be reasonably ready, they used to put a rope under their arms, make them go into the deep end, the instructor holding the rope, and he said, right, now swim to the shallow end, and he turned his back and was walking with his rope, and this poor chap would be drowning and spluttering, and it was horrific, it was not teaching. One of them said to me, I should change from becoming a telegraphist to becoming a physical training instructor swimming, but I declined the offer. At the end of the session, the last session, we were made to don our duck suits. Now, the duck is this heavy canvas material, very porous, which in the Navy, as far as I recall, is usually worn only by those who are in prison and other sort of problems. They had enough, much, I'm sure they have another purpose for hard, for heavy work or so on. They're very unpleasant things to wear, they're scratchy. And of course, having nothing on underneath, we were told to put on our duck suits and to swim a length. But once you're in the water, these things absorb water quicker than a sponge and become very, very heavy and drag you down. Of course, the instructors were watching. There were only about half a dozen of us doing this. And I think only about 3 of us managed the full length. And by which time, this thing was like a ton of bricks hanging on me. That we were made to do. And, you know, I was much fitter as a result of this. And we were then transferred to Aberdeen.
Just before we get onto that, what was morale like during the early stages of training?
Morale was, well, can't do anything about it. You've got to do what you've got to do. And, you know, and you can't get into trouble with the petty officers because they came down on you like a ton of bricks if you did anything badly or misconducted yourself in any way or were out of step, literally and figuratively speaking. It was tough going at times, but it hardened us a little bit. I wouldn't say it made us into supermen, it didn't. You need a lot more than we got there, but it knocked some of the sort of rough edges off us and made us a little bit more conscious of ourselves, and I think that probably made us a bit more mature too. Then was Aberdeen. Now, that was fantastic. That is where my telegraphy training started. I must, however, go back 1 second to the day I volunteered for the Navy when I was asked, have you got any special skills? And I said, yes, I speak and read and understand German fluently. I lived there for the first 12 years of my life. I've repeated that when I reported to HMS Royal Arthur on the day I joined, because they asked the same question. Nobody took any notice, obviously, because I went on with my telegraphy training, which took place in Aberdeen. We took a night train from Wetherby. We were each given a packet of 2 rounds of sandwiches. It was bitterly cold. The train wasn't heated. We had to be taken to Leeds to catch it. And the train was going to Edinburgh and was going to go all night long. There was no extra food, no extra drink. We all sat huddled in our greatcoats, trying to sleep, or otherwise telling jokes. And I'm pleased to get to Edinburgh in the morning, where fortunately they took us to the forces canteen and plied us with a breakfast, which consisted of streaky bacon, baked beans, a mug of tea, bread and marge. I think there was marmalade as well. And not nearly enough for us starving youngsters. But the train to Aberdeen wasn't leaving till about midday, so we were allowed out for a couple of hours and were told we had to report to the station an hour before the train was due to leave. And I went off with another couple of chaps, and we found a chip shop that had opened early, and we had some fish and chips, wandered around not too far from the station, Waverley Station in Edinburgh, and then caught the train to Aberdeen. I was with my friend all the time, this fellow Phil Anstey. When we got to Aberdeen, we were put onto a couple of lorries with a petty officer in charge, and it was evening, dark by that time, and saying, right, we'll stop in the dark outside various places. We'll call 2 here, 3 here, 5 here, whatever. Whoever's first off gets to stay there. So we're driving round, 2 here, stop, 2 here, 2 chaps jumped off. Kit was being delivered later. And eventually, we hung on a bit, Phil and I, and then suddenly we came to a place that seemed quite in the centre of town. And 3 here, off, he and I jumped. And another diminutive Scotsman jumped off as well. He was part of our group, but he sort of kept very much to himself. And I can tell you, we hit gold, because we found ourselves in a theatrical boarding house. The theatre was in Royal Terrace. The theatre was closed, and these two maiden ladies, the sisters Chalmers, had a boarding house for bit actors, you know. And in wartime they were doing this thing, and they were wonderful. They really were, they were middle-aged ladies. They looked after us like mums. We each had our own room. We had to be in by 10 at night, but they always arranged our beds to make it look as though somebody was in there. And whenever you came in at 11 o'clock or so, there'd always be a pot of tea, pot of cocoa with a tea cosy over the top, the plate of biscuits standing on the lounge table, sitting on table there. They really were champion. And whenever, on the rare occasion when a naval patrol came to check up, you know, they would open the door of the room very, a little bit, and say, "Dinna disturb the wee laddies, they're very tired, you know." And this sort of thing went on. We were so happy there. We did our training in Torrey, which used to be, it was on the sea, in the dockyard area, which used to be the fisheries experimental station, probably is again today. And that had been taken over by the signals branch, the naval signals people. And we had to go there on foot. There was no transport through the dockyard and so on. So initially we indulged in these silly nonsense things like blowing up condoms and floating them over the area. We soon stopped that. And there we were given very intensive telegraphy training by post office trained telegraphist civilians. And we worked very, very hard in classrooms. We each had our own Morse key. We each had our own earphones. You could communicate with the whole class as a whole or with individuals in the class. It was so arranged. And the training was extremely intensive. After work, you know, after our training, we were to go home. We had to go home. In theory, we were supposed to sit at home and learn Morse code and various other things. But we managed most of the time to avoid that and enjoy ourselves instead. Aberdeen was lovely. What a beautiful city. What lovely people, and how generous. Not tight-fisted as they were reputed to be. I had many interesting experiences there. Outstanding were Mary,